But for me, starting Diaspora as this business that was decolonizing the spice trade also meant that I wanted to really disrupt the image of who runs a spice company and who gets to be a spice expert. Historically, spice experts have all been white men, and there's nothing wrong with white men, but I think it's time that there were a few spice experts like from the culture that spices originated from. Naming my identity, whilst difficult, I think has actually been a real way to create community around the brand and define ourselves and who we are.
Welcome to Mindful Businesses, presented by Sarani, and I'm your host, Vidya Iyer. In our podcast, we bring to you brands which are mindful in their practices and processes. A mindful business adopts and employs sustainable social, economic, and environmental practices. Today, we have with us Sana Javeri Kadri, founder of Diaspora Co., building a better spice trade. Welcome, Sana.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on here.
Spices have played such an important role in world history, right from the conquerors, the empires which have fallen, the treaties which have been signed, treaties which have been flouted, explorers seeking new lands and trade routes, all for the best quality spice. I was born and raised in India, and, you know, India has an abundance of spice. The colonization in India was primarily for the spice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that has changed our world history? How do you think the spice trade has changed our world history?
The world history aside, I would say that global cuisines are completely changed by the fact that the British, the Dutch, the Portuguese all came to India looking for spices and went home, you know, with ships, highly, highly profitable ships packed with spices. So something I was reading about was that at the heyday of the pepper trade, British and Dutch ships were making a 300x, not a 300%, but a 300x profit on their pepper consignments. And because spices were actually the first luxury product. So they, more than the taste that they gave food, they were a status symbol and an indicator of class. So I actually compare spices today to what a Louis Vuitton handbag would be, which is that spices created an understanding of has and has nots and who has doesn't have. And in terms of flavor and French cuisine, Italian cuisine, even Filipino cuisine, like the movement of spices across the world has shaped how we eat today.
Your roots are from India.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you come to the U.S.?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Bombay. I'm a third generation Mumbai girl. And I moved to the U.S. about 7.5 years ago now. I moved here for my undergraduate, so to go to college at Pomona College in California. And my intention actually was to always move back to India. My understanding was that I'd be here for 4 years for college, then maybe I'd work here for a year or two, and then I would promptly return back to India. And now I actually live between India and the U.S. So I'm there between 4 to 6 months of the year, depending on the year, and here the rest of the time. So now I live in both worlds.
Talking about how the spices influence the cuisines, Indian food can be broadly divided into North and South Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
Are the spices available in the North distinct from what is available in the South or used in the South?
Yeah, you know, what's so interesting is that the spices that are used in the North are not necessarily grown in the North. And the spices that are used in the South actually tend to be grown in the South because the South is the spice growing region of the country. Spices that are grown in the North are much fewer and far between. A majority of the spices that we know, cardamom, pepper, turmeric, ginger, those can be grown in the North, but they grow abundantly and easily in the South. So the North, as often the more powerful, dynasties, were also importers and were bringing in these spices from faraway lands. And it's important to have that understanding of India, is that we're so vast and so diverse, and there were so many kingdoms and empires and nations within India, and that spices have, before colonization, were also exported and imported within what we now know as India. So there's always been a movement of these spices. and what people enjoy and what people don't is, I think, to some degree based in Ayurveda and in weather. So North Indian food tends to utilize a lot more of the warming spices, of the cinnamon, of the black cardamom that forms garam masala. And I think that's to do with having harsher winters and wanting something to heat your body up. Whereas South Indian cuisine, and I'm making huge generalizations here, but is more based on mustard, curry leaf, coconut, and less of the heaty spices.
True. I'm from South India and my masala dabba, the box which has the spices, has basically coriander seeds, cumin seeds, mustard seeds, right, and fenugreek seeds and few, right, chilies. So there are very few spices which are native to South Indian food and South India. And how much do you think these invaders who came primarily from the north, right? Initially, most of the invaders came from the Middle East, from the Silk Route.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think the cuisine and the spices they brought over influenced the cuisine in northern India?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so much of northern Indian cuisine is similar to Persian cuisine. There's huge influences there. And, you know, Persia's use of saffron, Persia's use of cardamom to a large degree, tremendously influenced what we know now as Indian sweets, which are so cardamom heavy. Those are Iranian, Persian influences at work. And also, I suppose, Middle Eastern at large influences.
One common belief that hot peppers actually are from India is a misconception. You probably know that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And they were brought by the Portuguese in the 1600s and have become so deeply normalized within Indian culture, so part of our culture. You know, India, chilies, it just makes sense. And so to realize that that was actually a 16th century entrant, though it's debated whether it was 14th century or 16th century, is a fun fact. And I think for me, an important conversation about the fact that food has migrated and moved around for thousands of years, and limiting the conversation of food to just local is actually limiting is actually doing a disservice to the history of your food.
Coming back to the spice and the spice trade, I feel the colonization, the premise of colonization of India was for the spices, as against the colonization of South America was for conversion, was for proselytization. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were missionaries sent through their churches. And the fact that people were fascinated by the spices, mm-hmm, that India offered changed India's history. You know, the religions were preserved, mm-hmm, because people were only concerned with trade.
Yeah, I would push back on that and say that, you know, yes, of course, it's a nice story to tell that they came for spices, but they came for power. And they were willing to let religions be because they realized that they didn't need to control people by religion in order to amass power. And actually, they could control us via religion by pitting us against each other rather than bothering to convert us. Yeah, I often talk about how so much of what our company's mission is about decolonizing the spice trade. And what that means is just redistributing power that formerly, you know, lived with the colonizers. But they had all the power over this industry. And then the colonizers left, but traders took over that power. And really shaking up that system and saying that the trader shouldn't have all the power. The farmer and the culture where these spices are indigenous to, that's where the power should reside. Power being money, capital, all of the above.
How did your journey start and what is your background? What did you come for your undergraduate degree to the United States?
I actually came here as thinking that I would either major in visual art or economics, two very different fields. And I attended Pomona, which was liberal arts. So I had a lot of choice. I had a lot of freedom in what I could study. Both my parents are architects in India, and so is my grandfather. So there's this long lineage of design and kind of social change through building. So I was definitely given a lot of leeway and freedom in what I wanted to study, as long as it was something I was passionate about and something that could be of service in some way. So I ended up getting my degree in visual art, mostly because I found that art was a freeing way to ask questions about the world and to critique what is going on around you. It allowed me to spend 4 years just learning and investigating anything that interested me and forming an opinion on it. And I actually now see how, as an entrepreneur, having those critical thinking skills, that creativity is very valuable. I was taught for 4 years to think independently. And but food and food systems and how supply chains work were always of interest to me. And I worked on the on-campus farm for all 4 years of university and proceeded to mostly have internships in the food industry, like from working on an urban farm to working at a bakery to working at an ice cream shop. I mean, I was just fascinated by all things food. So once I graduated, I got a food marketing job in San Francisco, which is why I moved up here to the Bay Area. And it really felt like the heart of the food movement. It felt like where farm to table was at its peak and just normalized, and you know, avocados were everywhere. It was a very sumptuous
place. When was that?
This was in 2016, so quite recently. Once I moved here, I think, and I started working from a food business point of view, I started seeing the huge gaps in the industry, specifically for anything in the quote-unquote ethnic food aisle, and seeing that, you know, the farm-to-table industry or supply chain wasn't extending globally and wasn't extending to anything outside of local farms, and that seemed like an interesting idea. So that's how the idea started to form.
You touched a little bit about equity and putting the power in the hands of the farmers. Mm-hmm. How is Diaspora Co. different than the early explorers and invaders?
Yeah, to dial it back one step, which is that in 2016, turmeric was really exploding here in the United States. And I was seeing that, but I didn't know who was supplying to the increased demand, who was providing or growing the turmeric for all of these turmeric lattes. And I had a hunch that whoever it was likely not doing it very equitably or doing it according to the standards that people assumed. It actually began for me as a question of like, who is supplying this demand? And then I went on a 7-month kind of journey back home to India, trying to answer that question. And the more time I spent visiting farms, visiting agriculture institutes, I spent almost 7 months just researching, the more I realized that there was a huge opportunity to disrupt the spice industry and the spice trade. And that's where this idea of decolonization and taking this very unjust system and making it more equitable started to develop. So the foundation of what we do at Diaspora is that we work with small single origin organic farms, which means that it's small family farms. They have between 5 to 20 acres, and we help them scale up. Say that they start out growing maybe 350 kgs. We, over a couple years, will help them scale up to as much as we need, which is anywhere from 2 to 10 metric tons. So that's anywhere from 4,000 to 20,000 pounds. We'll buy their entire harvest from them, and we pay them a price that they set. So we don't set the price. We kind of talk them through what did they need in order to really make money. That can often be anywhere from 2 to 20x the commodity price. 2x is for, you know, a very high value crop like cardamom, where the commodity price is maybe 1500 rupees. So we're paying, so to pay double that is already a huge deal. But most of the time we're paying between 10 to 20x the commodity price. And what we're doing there is we're realizing that the commodity price was set by this system that's rooted in colonialism, that's rooted in unfair labor practices. And so in order to really disrupt that system, you have to go far above and beyond. The fair trade price for spices, quote unquote fair trade, is only a 15% premium on the commodity price. And I found that there's no way a really high quality organic farmer growing regeneratively can make money without going into debt at just 15% over the commodity price. It's not viable. And I visited more spice farms than I would wager, you know, anybody in, at least in India. So that's been the basis of our model. And from there, we're also insisting on radical freshness, which is that all of our spices are grown the same year that we sell them, because we're buying the same year's harvest, we're selling through it, and when it's done, because we just bought it from one farm. So when we're sold out of a particular spice, you have to wait until next year, which is kind of